Welcome to this edition of Joffrey Maverick Memories Podcast, a companion project for the documentary film Joffrey, Mavericks of American Dance. This series will highlight personal stories from the alumni of the Joffrey Ballet Company during its more than 50-year history to give a unique inside perspective on what it was like to be part of this groundbreaking American dance company. Today's guest is Trinette Singleton, a principal dancer with the Joffrey Ballet from 1965 to 1971, and then again from 1974 to 1984, when she moved into a staff position and assumed the ballet mistress role in the company for many years. Singleton was the lead dancer in Robert Joffrey's most famous ballet, Astarte, a role which landed her on the cover of Time magazine in 1967.
When I was 8 years old, my mother and a friend of hers took me into Boston to see American Ballet Theater perform. They did Les Sylphides, Fall River Legend, and Graduation Ball. And at the end of the program, I turned to my mother and said, I want to be a ballerina. So she signed me up for lessons. And I started taking with a local teacher by the name of Harriet James. And that was when my ballet started. And then Harriet felt like I had some talent. And when I was 14, it was after I finished the ninth grade, she had a friend whose name was Lillian Moore. Now, she was a dance historian and a teacher at the Joffrey School in New York. So she got in touch with Lillian and said, you know, I've got this dancer. I think she's got some talent. You know, what do I do? So I ended up going to Joffrey School in New York in the summer of 1960 and loved it. And went back.
Like this was just like a summer intensive or something?
Yep. They run their summer intensive. It's usually an 8-week summer intensive, and I went for 4 weeks each summer from in 1960, 61, 62. And was
and
offered a scholarship.
You were in Massachusetts or
Massachusetts, yeah. Massachusetts. Yeah. That first summer my teacher took me to New York and stayed with me, and after that I went with another friend and, you know, just spent every day, all day, taking dance class.
Right, and who was teaching the classes normally? Was it? It wasn't Joffrey. It was probably.
Well, he did teach some. He was around. He had the company then that was eventually became the Harkness, and we would see the company dancers in class, and we'd be like standing in the door with our mouths open, you know, watching the professionals. And Lillian Moore, the woman that was the friend of my teacher that got me to go there, was one of the teachers. And it was people like Perry Brunson from Ballet Russe and Meredith Bayliss and Bea Tompkins. She was a Joffrey dancer. And Francois Martinet, they were dancers with that first group that went out in the station wagon, and they would teach at the school whenever they were not, you know, on the road or performing. And it was a great mix of teachers, and I just loved dance. So when I graduated from high school in 63, I was 17, I moved to New York, and I had a scholarship at Joffrey School and started, you know, living in New York and just dancing full-time. And a year later, the fall of 64, Joffrey was around because he had split with Harkness, and he would choose various ones of us at times and work with us privately and intensely. And he got a grant, I believe it was the fall of 64, to kind of reform because Harkness had, that split had occurred, and asked me to be a member of the company. And we started rehearsing in 65.
Is your time with Joffrey the first that you really did much with modern technique, or had you studied it before?
I hadn't had any modern. I had, growing up through high school, I had had, of course, the ballet and point, but I had also had ballroom dancing and tap dancing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he introduced us to people like Norman Walker and Glenn Tetley, and we started having to expand our, you know, he had a quote, ballet should be the center, not the circumference of your movement. So he felt that if all his dancers were classically trained and had a good, strong center, then it was easier for them to move into whatever movement the choreographers he had coming in wanted us to move into. Of course, some of it was much more comfortable than others. Sometimes you were really not in your comfort zone, but it stretched you as a dancer.
It is now widely known that the dancers chosen for Robert Joffrey's ballet Astarte were largely left in the dark concerning what the production would look like. Singleton remarks on that time.
The genesis of it, from what I hear, was that everyone involved didn't really know what they were making. It was purposely kept sort of
Mr. Joffrey could keep a secret like no one's business. He was a very private, in a lot of ways very private, and you what he didn't want you to know, you did not know. So of course that just leads to speculation beyond speculation. You know, what is he doing? What is he choreographing? What's it all about? You know, he'd call a large group and then he'd call two people, and he kept, I think in a lot of ways it was good PR. I mean, he kept a mystery about it. He hadn't done a piece of choreography in a while, and I think he kept pretty tight rein on it, on what was happening. I mean, we didn't even know it was going to be filmed until we'd been out on the West Coast. We did some summer residencies out in Tacoma at Pacific Lutheran University, and he worked on it a lot out there and in Seattle, all during that tour. And then we were in, I think it was either Iowa or Idaho, can't remember, one of those states. And the company managers said, well, I looked at some casting and I thought, why aren't I cast to dance this weekend? I mean, that was just like unheard of. And the company manager came and said, oh, you're on the red eye after a performance tonight. You're on the red eye back to New York with Mr. Joffrey and Max. And I'm like, why? And he goes, oh, Mr. Joffrey will explain it. Just pack your bag, and right after the show, you're going to get on a plane. So Max and Mr. Joffrey and I got on a red eye. And that was when he told us that we were going to film it. That was the first we knew about that.
Oh.
So, yeah.
And the understanding that I got from the filming was some of it was filmed like in nightclubs. You had a camera guy that went with you, and
yeah, that was just for some. That was just a little bit of in the beginning of the ballet. There's some shots of that kind of psychedelic nightclub scene, and then once the actual dance starts, it's just the two of us.
Right.
And that was all done in a film studio somewhere. I can't even tell you where.
Right.
Felt like we got locked in for about a weekend and just, you know, filmed.
And you were performing what you had already rehearsed previous. So you already knew the dancer you had been practicing.
Yeah. 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 Choreography had been done. We just were filming various segments of it in pieces. We still didn't get a lot of explanation from Mr. Joffrey, but, you know, other than, oh, well, there'll be a film behind you. You know, he didn't say that the whole screen was going to be moving and little details. He kept feeding us, you know, little bits of pieces of information.
Right. And so when did you sort of find out how it was all going to look? Really close to the performance time? Or?
Oh, yeah. Probably when we went into tech rehearsals.
Okay.
Then we sort of got the whole picture. And, you know, we knew it was risky. I mean, risky, the risk that Mr. Joffrey was taking. It was the first multimedia ballet, you know, a rock band in the pit and a moving films and kind of sexual, and it, you know, we got the whole picture, and it in a way was scary.
Yes.
So we just focused on the dance and what we were doing and how what our relationship with each other was, and did what we were told in terms of you got to be downstage on at this point and upstage on here, and the set's moving in here and out there, and you know, we had to focus on what we were doing, otherwise we could have gotten knocked into the pit, sort of.
Right. And then the stage door opening in the back, and
right,
Matt
right.
leaving down the
yep.
stage.
Yep.
So what do you
yeah.
think was the immediate reaction to the audience? I remember you saying in the film that they were shocked when Max would get up out of the audience and walk
oh, yeah.
and up to the stage, which I hadn't really considered until I read last night, that it was sort of an audience participation idea, you know, where someone could leap. Cease from being the audience member and suddenly become the performer on stage. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, it was just funny. People would, you know, he'd be walking through the aisle and people would say, sit down, sit down.
Oh. And then start undressing as he goes up the stairs.
Yeah, it was definitely, yeah, well, when the curtain first came down, it was kind of, I mean, like, almost, I guess you could say, a deafening silence because, you know, the rock band stopped, and that had been loud, and just silence, you know, and then the audience just erupted. And
wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess you guys were holding your breath, you know, not really sure what to, you know.
No, we were gasping for breath. It was a 30-minute pas de deux, and it took a lot of energy. We were gasping for breath. I had brought
happy,
my
and then happy
yeah.
that it turned out, you know, that the risk paid off, that it became this, you know, very well received piece. Some mixed reviews to begin with, but popular.
Well, Clive Barnes' first review of it was not good, and then he came back and saw it again, and he sort of retracted. He kind of wrote a second review going, you know, I don't, you know, sort of saying, look, it just took him so by, he didn't know what he was seeing, and sort of retracted it.
Mm.
I know I shocked the heck out of my parents. I mean, the piece did. Because I didn't tell them. I didn't tell them much. You know, I just said, come on, come down. You know, come down, this, see it. I didn't tell them much. I guess my cousin told me this. I don't know. I have no reason to doubt her, but she was sitting next to my mother. Like I said, a whole ton of family came down, and I guess at the end, everyone's on their feet. We were getting a standing ovation, and my mother was still sitting there, and my cousin leaned over and said to my mom, get up, that's your daughter. And my mother looked at her and said, that's no daughter I ever knew. So she got over it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sure, well, she was probably just as shocked as everyone else in the audience. Who,
yeah.
That's not what I...
She much preferred seeing me in Chantilly Tulle in Arpino's Vivaldi.
I asked you in the questions on the email, why did you, why do you think that you were the muse, sort of, for Astarte? Why did he choose you? And you said you didn't know.
Yeah.
Does it have,
I don't
know. Any thing to do with, you know, size or extension or flexibility, because it looks like a very athletic and acrobatic kind of dance.
I assume that he figured I could physically do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what he had in mind, some of the contortions and I always had a good work ethic, so maybe he figured I'd be willing to put in all the extra tough hours on it and not complain about it because of my work ethic and my willingness to just trust him to, even though it was a project that he wasn't forthcoming, he didn't come right out and say, well, this is what it's going to be. It was like bit by bit, and maybe he figured I would trust him enough to just not give him a hard time about wanting to know what is this all going to be, and, you know, just do the work and trust the outcome, maybe.
And how did you feel about it? I mean, like you said, this is a very controversial piece. It had a lot of themes in it that maybe some people would be bothered by if they were asked to star in it. How did you feel about it once you saw the whole picture of it and you saw what the dance was going to be? And was there anything in your mind that thought, you know, I don't know if this is going to be a good thing for my career, or I don't know?
Nope, nothing. Never. Never once thought that. I had such love and respect for the man that I trusted him completely. and I did what was asked of me. You know, whether or not it was going to be well received, I didn't know, but all I knew was that I needed to work my hardest and try to produce what he envisioned.
What do you think about Joffrey's vision? You know, his mixing of styles, that like we've said many times in the film, that it's kind of commonplace now to have lots of different elements within ballet technique.
Back then it wasn't, but his whole feeling was, because basically for years everything was based on a rep program. We eventually did some full lengths, but it was quite a ways into it. But he felt that he needed to. Okay, we're in New York. Competing against City Ballet and ABT, they do the big classics, the known stuff that everyone loves and reveres, and the classics. He knew to get an audience, he had to do something different, and not attempt to do anything that they were doing. So I think that was part of his vision, and his feeling that each program should be very eclectic, because he said, you know, if an audience, a person in the audience liked one piece and didn't like another, well, then they would be chatting in intermission. Well, the pros and cons of I like this one, I didn't like that one, yada, yada, and create talk. And as long as he felt like, as long as they liked one or two things, they'd come back another time. And that was why his dancers needed to be versatile. I mean, you'd be in point shoes in one ballet, and you'd be in character shoes or barefoot or in ballet shoes or sneakers the next. And it might be, you might be doing I might be doing the sea shadow pas de deux, which was a gorgeous pas de deux, two people, audiences loved it. And then the next ballet, I'd be groveling in the core somewhere doing a dramatic incubus with, you had to, no all-star, no star. You had to be able and willing to do whatever was asked. And it was interesting. I mean, it was interesting. You know, who wants to be the fourth swan from the right? His programming abilities were pretty amazing, in that he would do pieces like that from the past, and Petrushka and Green Table, pieces that had historical value. And then he would do well-known things from Ashton, like The Dream and eventually Cinderella, and Balanchine pieces. And then he would bring these new people that were unknown onto the scene. I mean, Twyla Tharp, he gave her a leg up, and Laura Dean. I mean, he was willing to mix past, present, and future mm-hmm. in a program or in a season. And I think that made it, then that way you're more apt to reach people. You know, you're not such a narrow base. He's had such a broad base. It was something for everyone. That's his thing, was there's got to be something for everyone. So he just would bring it all together, a piece from the past, a piece from the present, and something that's coming up in the future.
But he seemed to have a great reverence for masterpieces in the past, and that
were
important to keep alive or to keep people's knowledge of, which I think is somewhat unusual. Or maybe it's more from the modern sensibilities, the past is the past and leave it there. He was more of, we must keep this.
No, he believed in preserving it, you know. I mean, it's like, thank God now today there's things like the Tudor Trust and the Balanchine Trust, and then there's DeMille, and then there's now the Joffrey Foundation, and then Cunningham has got a foundation, where these organizations will be charged with preserving the works of these people from this past century, and I think that's important.
Thank you for listening to this edition of our podcast. Visit our website at www.joffreymovie.com. to sign up and receive a free series of digital photo books entitled Joffrey Maverick Moments. Find us on Facebook, Joffrey Ballet Movie. Follow us on Twitter at Joffrey Movie. And view our video clips on our YouTube channel, Joffrey Movie.